Hey guys, this is Bruce, and welcome to Convo Courses. And today I'm going to focus on something called Plan of Action and Milestones. And this came from a request. Somebody requested this one, so I'm going to focus on that one today. Before I start, just to kind of get you to know what's going on here. So Convo Courses is a community of people. We get together, we talk about cybersecurity, mostly GRC type stuff. That's governance, risk, and compliance. It's one aspect of cybersecurity that is often slept on. Like, people just don't talk about it. They just don't know about it. You normally, when you think cybersecurity, you think about hacking, or you're thinking about forensics, or you're thinking about something like that, some of the sexier aspects of cybersecurity. But you don't think about GRC, you don't think about documentation, you don't think about continuous monitoring, you don't think about disaster recovery, you don't think about all those kinds of things. That's mostly what I talk about, because that's mostly what my profession is in that right there. So somebody asked me about plan of action and milestone, and they were nervous about it. It's like a new ISO, a new information security officer, a new compliance officer, and they're like, man, what do I do with plan of action and milestone? Because that's a big part of my job. And before we get into that, I want to kind of give you a big picture of what this whole landscape looks like, right? Cybersecurity and GRC, governance, risk, and compliance. So one of the big things that we're trying to do is we're trying to manage the risk. What do I mean by that? So in an organization, you have hundreds and hundreds, or sometimes thousands and even millions, of vulnerabilities. What are vulnerabilities? It's weaknesses on servers, weaknesses on computers, on laptops, weaknesses on your phone, on mobile devices, anything with compute power, anything with storage, compute, or transferring data, anything can have a vulnerability. It could be a vulnerability, could be the firmware needs to be updated. It could be the operating system is on an old version of Macintosh. It's on an old version of Red Hat. It's on an old version of whatever. You choose your operating system. And those old versions, people are constantly using them. So they're going to find weaknesses. They're going to find ways to exploit it. They're going to find, you know, and there's just flaws that are built in by accident, usually by the manufacturer. There's just blind spots that they didn't know about, or something that is discovered much later. So those are vulnerabilities, like methods of people to bypass basic security features, or maybe something that's a flaw that makes it so that you have network congestion. All of those are what you call flaws in the code, in not only in operating systems, by the way. It could be in applications. It could be in physical security. Physical security could be like, hey, we really need a fence. We don't have proper fencing. We don't have proper physical security units, people walking around the area. We don't have proper badges. You know, people aren't wearing their badges properly. All of those can be exploited. Those are all things that can be used to somebody's advantage. So how do we, as cybersecurity people, as IT professionals, as GRC people, how do we deal with this? We're not going to fix 100% of everything. The name of the game is managing the risk. That's what we're doing. We're managing it to an acceptable level, to where we can perform our business and mission functions, the basic things that we need to do, and not lose money, not lose people, not lose resources. Some of these systems are life or death. You know, sometimes if the system goes down a long time, it's not just money or reputation. It could be life or death. We're talking about very important systems in some cases. Some national security systems are dealing with things that might be life or death. So there's different levels of risk that an organization can take, this is not one size fits all, right? So when you go from, I'll use myself as an example. When I've gone from DOD say Air Force, I worked for a unit in the Air Force, and then I moved over to another unit at NASA. Completely different. Like, they're both using NIST 800, but the way they interpret how to use it is pretty different. Once you know NIST 800 or whatever framework you're using, whether it's HIPAA or it's PCI DSS or Sarbanes-Oxley or whatever framework or standard or whatever you're using, once you understand it enough, wherever you go, you're going to understand what's going on. And that's kind of what's happened with me. So when I go from one federal organization to another, it's different, but I can very quickly pick up and like, oh, okay, that's what they're trying to do here, right? And their interpretation is slightly different on this particular control than this other organization. They do things differently here. And the environment's completely different. When you go from one place to another, the environment is completely different, and they have slightly different terminology. They have a different way of doing things. So it's going to be different from place to place. But the name of the game is the protection of your confidentiality, integrity, and availability. That's really the name. When you strip everything away, that's what you're trying to do. And you're trying to maintain a certain level of security posture. All that means is a certain level of security. We're managing the risk to where we can get things done. It's kind of like everywhere you go, there's risk, right? If you walk down the street, you can be hit by, God forbid, you get hit by a car, you can fall down and hit your head and get a concussion, car can jump the curb and hit you, whatever, right? There's a certain level of risk with everything we do. Just breathing has a certain level of risk. The thing is, we have to manage that risk in our life. So if it's too high of a risk, we might not have to go outside because there's a tornado out there, you know what I mean? But on a normal day, it's like, okay, I can manage the storm. It's just a light storm. I can go outside. I can manage this risk. I can deal with the risk of the storm pushing my car around as I'm going. But sometimes the risk is too great. So the organization's job and our job as risk as cybersecurity people doing GRC is to help the organization to manage the risk. And notice I say help. We're not doing everything. That's one of the misconceptions. When you get in, you think that you're supposed to do everything, and you're not. You're not supposed to know everything. Nobody knows everything. You can't. It's just not possible. So what we're doing as an organization is all of us are taking some portion of the risk, and in order to make the system work effectively, to do the business and mission that we need to do, in a way that's secure as possible. That's the name, that's what we're doing here. We're protecting information, the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of the information going forward in that organization. But let me show you how organizations do this. So one of the ways that they do this is by having something called risk responses. The risk response looks a little something like this. Let me show you what I mean by a risk response. And now if you happen to be watching me, I'll describe it, everything I'm seeing here on the screen for those who are listening. But a risk response looks a little bit like this. So an organization has to figure out how they're going to respond to different levels of threats and different vulnerabilities, and how they're going to respond to it is known as a risk response. So they can avoid the risk by completely eliminating the cause. They can mitigate the risk by fixing it, remediation of the risk. My producer back here is telling me, they can accept the risk acceptance, or they can transfer the risk. So those are some of the things that you can do with risk. And I can just very quickly kind of go through, give you an example of each one. Avoid the cause of the risk would be like if you had a system that that had a browser that was out of date, right? And this the assumption is that this system, let's say it's a server and it has a browser and the browser's out of date. So let's say that the risk is that somebody's going to be on a server and then they're going to use that browser, and it's going to get exploited because the browser's out of date. Well, one of the new things you can do to completely avoid the risk is to remove the browser entirely, or remove it from the internet. Like, they don't even have access to the internet. The thing is exploitable, but there's no access to the internet, and therefore there's no risk. Mitigation of risk would be that same browser, we update it. We update it to the most current version of browser. Acceptance of risk to say, look, we need that browser, that current version, that old legacy version of the browser, we have to leave it on. The organization knows what's up. We already know that we have to fix it. We're going to accept the risk. But what we're going to do while we accept this risk is we're going to have a contingency control, which means maybe we didn't update the browser, but what we can do is we'll put some sort of protection on the system that alerts us if somebody's trying to tamper with the browser. So you have contingencies in place to help you to mitigate the risk, to lower the risk a bit, even though you couldn't actually fix the risk or mitigate it or avoid it. So that's acceptance. And so normally acceptance of risk, by the way, and there's different names. There's exceptions. The organizations call it different things. Exceptions, acknowledgement of risk, I've seen it called that. Normally they have a document that says, okay, we know that this is a risk. Here's the browser. It's related to SI2 law remediation. But here's the contingencies that we're putting in place. We have a firewall in place. We don't allow anybody to get on that system that's not an authorized user. It can't browse to certain sites. It can only go to these three sites right here. It's got a whitelist to where it can only go to these three places. There's different things that will be in that document that say, look, we're accepting or acknowledging, or it's an exception. However, here's the mitigating. Here's what we're going to do to lower the amount of risk that we're going to take. So transfer of risk is where an organization will say, we're going to hire another organization, and they're going to help us to manage the risk. We're going to hire Mandiant, or we're going to hire CrowdStrike, or we're going to hire a whole other organization, and they're going to take care of that piece of that risk for us. And so you're transferring it to a third party. So those are some of the things that you do for risk response. An organization has to, as a whole, say, here's how we're going to respond to certain risks. Here's some of our answers. Now, what you don't see on here is something called a plan of action. It has many different names: a plan of action, and milestone. Sometimes it's action plan, but essentially what it is we can't fix it now. We can't avoid the risk. We can't transfer the risk. And we don't want to accept it. We're going to fix it, but it's going to take time. And so that would probably, I don't know where you put it on this spectrum of risk. You might even give it its own category of risk response. Maybe mitigation. I'm not sure where you would put it here. But a plan of action is a part of a risk response, though, I would say. Because what I didn't know until recently is that it's not just the government that does this. It's everyone does these things that we just talked about, and everyone has something called an action plan. It's a common thing. So what I want to do is show you what an action plan looks like, a plan of action. I'm going to show you what the federal government uses for action plans. And it's, just keep in mind, it looks different. It's looked different every organization I've gone to. Even within the federal branches, it's looked different. And so just keep that in mind. But there'll be certain elements that you'll always see with a plan of action. I've also seen it in the private sector. They didn't call it a plan of action, a milestone, but they did have it. And it was a very, very important piece of risk response. So let me show you what that, and I'll walk you through it if you happen to be listening to me or you can't see it because you're on TikTok or whatever. I will walk you through what we're seeing here. So this, what you're seeing here, and if you want to get a copy of this, This is free on the internet. You can just, this one comes from the FedRAMP site. FedRAMP has some really good documents that you can use. And if you're thinking, well, that's FedRAMP, I'm not on the cloud, I don't. So FedRAMP is NIST 800. That's all it is. It's just NIST 800 with some extra steps. So all their documents are pretty much the same. Like they still use a system security plan. They still use a plan of action and milestone. It looks exactly the same. It just goes through this extra step for cloud. So that, keeping that in mind, you can download this for free. Just go to Google, type in FedRAMP documents or FedRAMP POAM. Or you can go to my site, congrocourses.net, and I have a place where you can download a bunch of templates that I've already curated and gone through and picked all these ones, all the best ones, and put it on my site so that you can go ahead and cherry pick the ones you want. But if you want to follow along, it's free. So let me show you my screen and I will walk you through it if you happen to be listening to me. Let's see here. Here it is right here. This is a plan of action and milestone. So at the top, you'll have the system name, right? You've got each plan of action and milestone, or a POAM or a plan of action, it is set on a specific system, on a specific control. So it's system, you're not going to have one plan, usually, you're not going to have one plan of action that covers every control on a system. Normally it's very targeted, and you'll understand why as we get into this. So the plan of action is going to be specific to one system, and it's going to be usually specific to one weakness that's on the system, one vulnerability is addressing. And that's an important thing to understand, and most organizations do it like this. Okay, so now check this out. It starts out with the name of the system. And of course, you can have some other information there. It's pretty important, like the date that it started, and then like the level of the system. And that's really important too, because if it's a high impact system to a low impact system, it's gonna affect how quickly we get things done. It might affect how many resources we throw at it, how much money, time, energy, and people we throw at the problem to fix it. There's many different factors. So the impact level is important. So that's in the very top field that we're looking at. Now, as we dig into this, the very first field we see below that is what's called a plan of action ID, or action plan ID. Some unique identifier that's going to identify this specific plan of action, because there may be many. So I've been gone to organizations that had hundreds of them, hundreds and hundreds of them, you know. So you want to have some sort of method of identifying that specific one, because you can have 100 different plan of actions that address very, very similar weaknesses within the organization. Like you can have 100 of them or 200 that all are addressing some aspect of Windows Office, right? And one is affecting one ask, this is security updates of Windows Office, and then the other one is dealing with the .NET feature of Windows Office, and the other one dealing with a different aspect of the patching feature of Windows Office. They could all be different. So a unique identifier is important, because it's going to identify that specific thing that you're addressing. So that's why the unique identifier is very important for your plan of action and milestone, or your plan of action. So the next thing is to identify what controls this affects. So in this 800, you have hundreds and hundreds of different controls, are in place to address different weaknesses and security features of your organization. So I'm going to edit this document as we talk about it. So in this example here, what I'm showing on the screen is, what I'm showing on the screen is AC1. So AC1, I mean, it's a little bit bigger. AC1 is access control policy. is what it is. And it looks like they just kind of randomly threw some stuff in here because this doesn't really, I'm reading it and it doesn't pop, but we'll just make some stuff up here. So AC1 is actually access control policy. And if you didn't, so an example of a weakness would be that the organization doesn't have an updated version of access control policy. So what you would do here is you would explain that in the weakness name. You would explain, hey, the organization doesn't have it wasn't signed. They have a policy, but it wasn't signed by the organization. And you would just explain that. Org one does not AC not addressed in policy. So you could say something like that. And now what we're going to do is describe how we're going to fix it, who's going to fix it. So a plan of action milestone is just addressing of who, what, when, where, and why. Like, that's it. It's super simple. If it's answering who, what, when, where, and why, and how, that is going to cover everything of your, that's everything you need. That's your plan of action milestone. That's what it does. If it answers those questions, you know you're going in the right direction. Now, if your organization has a plan of action process, but they don't, it's not addressing the who, what, when, where, and why. Like, you can't give it to somebody else and they can't figure out like who is going to be the person who's going to fix this. Where, what time frame are we going to fix it in? What do we need to fix it? And what is it actually addressing? If it doesn't address those things, then you as a cybersecurity GRC person could come go to the organization and say, hey, you know, we should probably add a POC portion to this document. We should probably, because this doesn't have a POC portion. And I've been in organizations where, you know, it was a little lacking, so you just massage it and get it a little bit better. So, and I'm seeing questions pop up on TikTok and on YouTube and Facebook and stuff, so I'll address those after this. I just want to get through this. So, and I'll go through this pretty quick. So, we talked about the name, we talked about the control that we're talking about here. Then the description of the weakness and other information. So this is where you would just describe more of what's going on. We'd say organization one has a policy that's in place. However, it doesn't address AC controls. We're gonna add the AC controls to the policy, right? So we just describe what's going on. And then the next one, we're talking about how was this weakness discovered? And that's called the weakness detector source. I mean, you can call it whatever you want, but essentially is how do we discover this particular weakness? And in this case, maybe it was from an inspection we had. And then they would look through all of our policies and they can see, okay, these guys have a policy, but the AC controls wasn't addressed. Oh, they don't have a separate AC control policy that's addressing access control. So it was, and you would put in here that it was found via IG inspection or whatever. Now, in this example that I'm showing on the screen here, it's showing that Nessus was a scanner, a network scanner was used. And that's one way that you could, there are many different ways that you could discover a weakness. Like, it could be just a routine self-assessment that you guys do annually or something, or it could be a scanner, like you ran a scan and you saw that these systems were vulnerable. It could be any number of things. So you would just put the source there. Weakness identifier. Now, this is if you had some kind of method within your organization of identifying the weakness by itself. An example of this that they give here is the Nessus plugin numbers. But there's many different ones. Qualys has its own plugin numbers. You know what? Scanners have like a number that they assign different weaknesses, and so this is where you would put that if it was applicable. And in our case, we're talking about an AC1 policy, missing policy. So maybe we leave that blank. And then the next one is asset identifier. What systems? What computers? What servers were affected by this? It could be, you could put here IP control, the IP addresses, the actual DNS name or whatever system was affected here. In our case, maybe we just put policy, the security policy, org one security policy, and that's not an asset, so maybe we just leave that blank. Or maybe you could put all assets, because you could say, if you know, your interpretation is that, well, all of the assets rely on AC controls, you could say that. But I think my interpretation of this, you see how there's like a lot of different ways to see it? My interpretation is that they're looking for an actual system, so I would just leave it blank. PLC speaks for itself. What's our main PLC? Is that the dog? I thought, okay, never mind. Who is our main PLC to fix this? So in our case, it might be the information system security officer. It might be the information system security manager. Whoever's responsible for actually updating the policy is going to be the person. It's going to be the person who's actually going to do the work, or the manager of the person who's going to do the work. That's who you put there. The go-to guy or lady who's going to be the person that says, yep, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do it like this, this, and that. All right, so let's go through a couple more of these that are really important for the who, what, when, where, and why. Overall remediation plan. One really, really important thing, every action plan, is how it's going to get done. So that requires a time frame. When was it detected, and when are we going to get this done? Super important. Super important to your plan of action. When is it going to get done? So normally, just some words of wisdom here, give yourself way more time than you need. If the system team or whoever is fixing the system says it's going to take me 6 months, man, try to take a year. Get as much time as you can, because stuff happens. So in this case, we're talking about a policy. So we would talk to, normally what I do is I talk to the person, the PLC, who's going to do this, and I say, how long is it going to take? And they say, oh, man, you know, it'll take me 4 weeks to do this. And I say, okay, well, let's give it a little bit more time, and I'll try to help you out so we can get it done faster, but let's give it a little bit more padding so that we can get it done in our time, within the time frame and under budget. As much as possible, you know how things are. Like, every organization is different. They always want stuff way faster than you can do it, but get as much time as you can. Another really important part of the plan of action milestone is the actual milestones. So milestones, that means we're going to do this, and then we're going to do B, and then we're going to do C. It's where you break down each part of how you're going to do it. So in it with dates. On this date, we're going to do X, and then on this date, we're going to do this, and then on this date, and then you update this, because sometimes this will change. Things happen where you have dependencies, and so you might have to change this. Like, maybe you discover that your main PLC is gone, and you guys have to hire another person to actually do that policy. So that changes the milestone a bit. That's going to change the time frame. So you got to go back in there and change it. And so that's where the next part comes in, is the milestone changes that have taken place. The status is also very important. When was it last updated? And what are we doing right now with it? What step are we on? That's something that I've seen done really well at some organizations. And so that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Your plan of action and milestone, you remember nothing else from this. The plan of action and milestone is one of the methods that the organization uses to help manage the risk. You're not going to fix everything immediately. It's just not possible. There's too many moving parts, and any organization says, we're going to fix 100% of everything, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. It's probably coming from some manager who's not in the weeds and not doing this stuff on a regular basis. It happens, but you're not going to fix 100% of everything. It's not going to happen, right? Especially bigger. Maybe you have one system, right? You have one, two systems or something like that. But if you have the more systems you have, the more complex it is, the more it's just not going to get done in the time frame with the resources you have. It's just not. So the best you can do is manage the risk. And so if you take nothing else from this, a plan of action milestone is planning how you're going to fix a weakness that's in your organization. It could be physical weaknesses, software, hardware weaknesses, technical resource issues. It can cover any part of any weakness in your organization. And it's going to cover the who, what, when, where, and how that you're going to fix it. That is a plan of action milestone, that for an action plan in a nutshell. That's how you do it. All right, let me address some questions here. I've been talking for about 30 minutes, and I appreciate everybody showing up. Let me start with this first one here. Cybertrap says, you're already set up for broadcast right now, but next time I would suggest bringing a microphone closer to your face. that has a quality voice. Will do. I think maybe something might be wrong with my mic, actually. Something might be wrong with my mic, and I cannot fix it right now. Really? Oh, yeah. Okay. That's what they were trying to tell me. Hey, your mic, something's wrong with your mic. And that, which means I might have to do the shit over again. Appreciate you. Thanks for that. And I should have read that message immediately. Let me see. Let me find some other comments. How am I sounding on TikTok? Can you guys hear me? Maybe the TikTok will be better. I might have to delete this video. Sounds one thing you can't fix. All right, random questions. How valuable is a TSSCI with Poly? Depends on where you are, what you're doing. But overall, it's pretty valuable, especially an active one. Because it's very expensive for an organization to get you one. So a TSSCI, by the way, is a top secret compartmentalized, SCI, I can't remember. It's been a while. Compartmentalized information, something. I don't remember what the S is. Sensitive compartmentalized information? I don't know. But anyway, it's a secret, top secret clearance. And it costs an organization a lot of money for them to do it. So, it's expensive. So if you have one and they don't have to redo it for you, then it's valuable. It's valuable. On the East Coast, I know that a lot of people are looking for them because there's a lot of federal jobs there that are looking for those kinds of people with those, with an active one, especially. Sounds pretty fair on YouTube. Okay, thank you. Appreciate you. Thanks, James. Okay. All right, great. Thank you. Appreciate that. He's about to stop this whole thing to redo it. Okay. James. Oh, James, you're on both? What the hell? I just saw your question here, man. Okay, it says, can you touch on the update to the NIST framework? Are you talking about the NIST cybersecurity framework or the NIST 800 risk management framework? Because both of those in the past 3 years have gone through changes. And I can speak a little on NIST cybersecurity framework, which just went to version 2. I can speak on that one a bit because I've been looking at that one to update my own personal knowledge about it. And I can kind of go through that one. But which one are you referring to? NIST 800. I'll talk about both. So let's start with the most recent change. The most recent, while I'm bringing this up, the differences between these two things. There's two different frameworks we're talking about here. NIST 800 Risk Management Framework, which is for the federal, it's the main framework that the federal government uses, the U.S. federal government uses. It's very robust. It has like 1,000 different controls. It has about 20 different control families. And it's got a 7-step process of going through and fixing your, and making your system security better. And let's talk about that one first. So the changes that were made, and I'll keep it brief on each one of these. Let me show you my screen here, and I'll talk you through it if you can't see. So this is NIST 837. And the reason why I go to this one so much is because this is this breaks down the risk management framework process that federal organizations are supposed to do. So they in the last couple years, they went from Rev 1 to Rev 2. And it's in GRC terms, it's pretty recent. I know it's saying here, like 2018, but this stuff changes pretty slow. So there's some people who are just getting off of Rev 1, just to kind of give you an idea how slow it goes. Because they base their entire security on that. So it's kind of like if you were turning a gigantic ship around, right? If you're it's just going to take a while to turn it around to do that U-turn or to make any kind of course corrections. So Rev 1, what can I say about Rev 1? So NIST 837 Rev 1, it had privacy in it, but it didn't put privacy up front like Rev 2 does. That's one of the main changes that I've noticed. Privacy is right from jump when you start reading it, privacy is right in your face, and it's peppered throughout every single control family because they've taken PII very, very seriously in Rev 2. It to the point where it's every you can't ignore it, right? They put it in your face, and they're always looking out for privacy right next to cybersecurity stuff. So that's probably one of the biggest changes that I noticed. Another big change is that they added a step, and really, it's a step we all do. It's the preparation step. So they didn't have that in the previous Rev 1. It went straight into categories. So let me show you what I mean by that. Categories, category security categorization. NIST 800 meta framework, and then go to images and kind of show you the wheel, color wheel we're talking about here. So if you can see my screen, and if you can't, I'll explain it. Yeah, here it is right here. So in the middle, you didn't have in risk management framework version one, revision one, you didn't have that middle piece. So the middle piece wasn't there. So now they added that, and it's something we normally do anyway. The middle piece is the prepare step, where all we're doing is we're gathering all the documentation, gathering the information, reaching out to people to figure out who needs to be involved with this process, NIST 800 process. So that is prepare, the prepare step. And there's some other changes that they made. They changed all the control. They changed the control families as well, the actual controls. It is referring to the NIST 800 53 Rev 5, Rev 4, Rev 4. So that's another thing that changed. NIST 800 30 Rev 5, Rev 5, Rev 5. Okay, my bad. So it went to Rev 5, and Rev 5, it once again integrated more of the controls. Privacy controls in there and put privacy right up front. And then they also changed a bunch of the controls. It's mostly the same. I would say 80% of it is the same. There's a 20% that has changed. They added a couple families. So yeah, about 20% of it has changed. It means definitely you can tell if you do this for a while, like which one is Rev 4 and which one is Rev 5. Once you start getting through it, you'll notice some things are gone and some things have been replaced. And they added a couple control families. One of the main ones is a privacy family called PT, which is PII and transparency, which is how the organization deals with PII. So that's a big one. And so those are the main changes with NIST 800. Now let me address NIST 800, NIST Cybersecurity Framework. So this one recently changed, like within the last couple of weeks. They've been working on it for a couple of years, but they recently changed it. And I've been looking at it a bit so I can talk a little bit about it, but I'm still learning myself about it. The main thing I noticed is that they added another control family. But basically, what they did, I noticed, is that they took out one of the control groups and moved it to something called governance. So this is going through how they're going to change everything. I'm looking for the actual updated document so I can show you what I mean here. So, okay, so first of all, let's back up. What is NIST cybersecurity framework? So NIST cybersecurity framework, it is a different thing from the NIST 800 risk management framework. Whereas NIST 800 is for federal government to come through and go through all the, to manage their risk effectively and apply certain controls to their systems. The cybersecurity framework, NIST cybersecurity framework, takes a different approach. First of all, it's not just for the federal government. It's for everyone. It's open source and it's for everyone. And actually it's very effective. It's being used internationally. It's being used by private organizations. It's being used everywhere right now. The reason why it's very effective is the way that they address things. So the way they address stuff is by functions that your organization needs. And so those functions are very basic. It's, let me show you here on my screen, and I'll walk you through what we're seeing here, if you happen to be listening. So it has, how do we identify? Identification is identification of what kind of vulnerabilities we have, what is our actual business, what are we protecting, what are the main things we protect. You're identifying what is going on. And then the next part is protection of what you've identified, protection of your assets, right? So this can apply to Walmart. This can apply to a gas pipeline. This can apply to a government, all kinds of governments. So the way they're addressing it is different. Whereas the NIST 800 is very specific to, I mean, you could use it at Walmart or wherever store or another country or something, but there's some things there that are, Walmart doesn't need. Right, there's a lot of things in the NIST 800 that a lot of organizations just won't. It's just too extreme. But the NIST cybersecurity framework is based off of functions that every organization needs. You've got to identify what are your assets. You've got to identify the weaknesses there. You've got to identify all the things you need to secure it. And then protection. Everybody needs some level of protection on those assets that they identify. And then how do we detect anomalies? How do we detect if somebody's trying to hack our systems? How do we detect if there's a flaw in our code? How do we, so scanning, things like that, it addresses those kinds of things. Response, once we do discover somebody hacking our system, how do we address that? And then recover, we got hacked, our system's down. How do we recover after we know that the system's down? So the cybersecurity framework addresses all those things. Now, in the new version of it, the addition there is that ring in the middle. There's a yellow ring here that's called govern. And governance is about management of the organization. And that's the big change. So in the previous one, by the way, they had governance in there. It's not like, it's not a new concept. It's not new to this. NIST cybersecurity framework. It's in there. Governance was put in, it was put in a couple of different functional areas. I believe they had governance in identify, and they may have had it in protect. I don't recall, but basically they took it out of those other sections and gave it its own section so that they can focus on that better. So governance. Govern has its own ring now, and it looks pretty similar the way they've done this to ISO 27001. Now that I'm looking at it, because ISO 27001 has a whole clause about governance, like it's all the first thing you do is govern the system, like who are the leaders, who's leadership, and do they have the proper resources, and are they on board with doing security. That's ISO 27001, and it's kind of looking like a little bit like ISO 27001. So though that's the main difference. Once I get deeper into it, I'll be able to explain a little bit more about it. I would like to talk about it actually in greater detail. But it just recently changed, like in the last 3 weeks it changed. They've been working on it for like years. Okay, let me give TikTok some love here. So I just had a bunch of people bounce out of here. let me see. Somebody said, I have a question. I manage cyber for big places. We just did a full external and internal pen test. Okay, what's the question? I need to put a remediation plan together, okay, and get teams to address the issues, but I need some guidance. Okay, so this is a great segue into what I was talking about. So one of the things you can do is use the NIST CSF, NIST Cybersecurity Framework. So NIST Cybersecurity Framework talks about exactly how to do what you just said. I don't know how deep you want to go into it, but what it does is it sets an organization up for success because it's addressing all the things that they need to have a very thorough breakdown of everything that they need to do. How to identify assets, how to protect, detect, respond, and recover in their organization under if they've gotten under attack. But it sounds like you're just looking for like a template for a remediation plan and some guidance on how to do that. What straightforward thing could you use to do that, a remediation plan? So in organizations that I've worked in, what we did was after an assessment, what they'll do is they'll have what's called an RAR, a remediation assessment report. And all that does is break down all the things you've discovered. You have a technical piece of it and you have a non-technical piece. The RAR, the remediation assessment report starts off, and you can find this template on the internet. So just go to the internet and type in remediation assessment report, or RAR. That's how the government, U.S. government uses it. But the template's going to be similar no matter where you go. The first part of it is going to be an executive summary. The executive summary is like a short message to leadership. And the reason why you do that executive summary, it's just a few paragraphs, is because they don't really have time. Your C-level execs, your CIO, your CEO, those guys they're busy doing other stuff, right? They don't really have time to really mess around with the technical piece, and a lot of times they're not very technical. So an executive summary of your remediation report, you want to break down overall what you found, right? Like if you see that there's a medium risk, a low risk, or a high risk, you want to hit those things right off the bat using non-technical terms as much as you can. You just want to explain what's going on. So you might say, it might go like, we ran a scan on this date, this team ran a scan on this date, and we discovered 15 critical findings. Most of these critical findings have to do with access control. Right, you would just right away break down exactly where the problems are. Right, so it's not technical, it's very overarching. The stuff that if you were to inform the CIO, the main thing you want to tell them right up front, right? You don't go into details, of course. There might be some other things that you guys found in your pen test, you're going to explain that later. In this first part, you want to hit all the main things the summary of what you found, of your findings. Sum it up in a few paragraphs, boom, you're done. Then you get into the technical piece. The technical part is gonna be specifically for the people who are gonna remediate the findings. It's gonna explain exactly what you found, where you found it. It's gonna be very technical. It's gonna, if you guys did a pen test and you found, excuse my ignorance, I'm not a pen tester, but let's say you guys ran, you guys did Nmap and you found a vulnerable web page and it's you're able to see clear text passwords or something, usernames or something. It's going to explain how you found it, and then after you explain how you found it and what the vulnerability is, because you want to also explain like why that's bad. Like it's going to explain like what you found, why it's bad, very briefly. It's bad because somebody could use the admin account to get in there and exploit the whole system, right? And then it's going to explain how to fix it. And you're going to put all of that throughout. This is going to be a real long part of the document. So a lot of times what people will do is they'll have two separate parts. They'll have a main piece of the document that's broken down for non-technical people. It's like a three-page document that's going to explain, like, here's everything. There's a summary in the beginning, and here's the stuff you probably need to worry about. And then when it goes into the real deep technical stuff, it's going to have appendices that go into great detail about what was found, why it's bad, and how to fix it. And that remediation plan is what you can deliver to the customer so that they can take that and fix it, right? And it's prioritized. So that's very important too. You want to prioritize it right from the beginning. Like in the executive summary, you're going to prioritize what's most important because you might have found 100 different things there, but probably not going to fix all 100 things. But you want them to fix these main 10 things, these top main 10 things. And if they can get to those main 10 things, maybe there's another set of 20 things that you want them to do next. You want to prioritize it right from the beginning. The biggest thing we found were these 15 critical findings where we can see the clear text passwords on these mission essential applications that you guys are using. And then explain like what can be exploited. Another thing a very effective thing you can do if you have time in the document, if you have an active audience on it, is tell them where other people were exploited using that same vulnerability. So that's what I would do. There's tons of templates that you can use online that are for free. I might even have a free template on some. Yeah, I might have one. Just go to combocourses.net. I've pulled a couple of examples of templates you can use for a risk assessment report. But if mine aren't good, you can just go to Google and find some. All right, let me see here. We've been talking for about 1 hour. I'm gonna pull a couple more questions from YouTube. Let me see here. Okay, I got a question from Larry. Hey Larry, how you doing, man? He says, in the federal agency that I work for, we deal with a lot of software development and technical and tech solutions for other agencies. Okay. We use the FISMA compliance levels low, moderate, and high. And oh, okay, yeah. So yeah, that's what we're using too. We're at low, moderate, and high, which is in line with FISMA and NIST 800 and stuff like that. Same thing. We might even work for the same organization. let me see. Okay, let me see. Got more questions on TikTok. I'm just gonna go through and see if I can find some more questions. I'm getting leadership buy-in to get findings addressed, and some are for the near future. That's awesome, man. That's an awesome position to be in. It's really cool to be a part of something like that where you find stuff that has a great impact on the organization. And then that's one of the very satisfying things that I've noticed about cybersecurity, that I like about cybersecurity, is that you have a great impact, even though you're not thanked for it. They don't thank you for. It's funny, like if you just set up a new network. I used to be a network engineer. If we set up a network that they really needed, everyone's like, oh, high fives and wow, great, that's awesome. You know, now we can access the internet from here or whatever. It was crazy. It was like you just won the Super Bowl or something. But cybersecurity doesn't get that kind of props, even though you know what kind of impact you had on the organization. Because if you discovered some crazy vulnerability that wasn't exploited, and you're part of the team that shut that closed that door on that hole, you know the impact that you had on that organization. So assessments give you that feeling, and then I guess pen testing too. I've never done pen testing, but being a part of the team that discovers vulnerabilities and then helps to fix those or sees those things get fixed, you see the impact that you have on that organization. And that's kind of fulfilling, especially if it's like a bank or something. Let's see here. More questions. I don't know what's going on with TikTok lately. Usually I have a whole bunch of people in here that are asking questions, but right now it's nothing. Crickets. I don't know what's going on with it. It's weird. Probably the time frame. I started really late. Had some stuff to do today. And I won't hold you guys too long. I'm just going to answer a couple more questions. Okay, let me see here. How many security control families from the NIST 800 to the NIST Rev 5 to Rev 5 and Rev 4? And I know it sounds crazy. I don't remember off the top of my head. I want to say it went from 18 to 20, but I think I'm maybe wrong. Rev 5, Rev 4 versus Rev 5. I know that they dropped a couple from Revision 4 and added some new ones from Revision from the newest one. Let me see here. So I know that they added PT controls, which is privacy and transparency, and 20 controls in the NIST Rev 5. 20 controls. Families of controls now. And then in four, it's also 20. Let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 18. Yeah, I was right. 18 in Rev 4, and then 20 in Rev 5. I think. I'm not super sure. Oh man, it's bad. Yeah, 18 in Rev 4, and then 20 in Rev 5. Second guessing myself, man. That's an easy one. Easy win. And I had to look it up on Google. let me see if I got any other questions here. Could you kindly share some information on how to properly decommission a system while maintaining mid-level confidentiality, integrity, and availability? I can tell you how organizations I've worked for have done it. So what he's asking is, decommissioning means like you have an old system and they have to get it off the network, for example. That's one example of it. It could be it's being replaced, you're just removing it, and the functionality is going to be gone. It's any number of things that are happening, but decommissioning just means we're no longer going to use this system and we got to get it off the network. And the issue, one of the biggest vulnerabilities that you see in organizations is end of life end of support systems. Organizations will get very dependent on certain systems. They'll write code around, like, say, Windows 7, Windows 10, or whatever. They'll write code around it, an old version of Windows 7 or an old version of Windows 10. And that code is mission essential, or business, it's a business essential function. And then the old software it has so many holes or so many vulnerabilities or so many things wrong with it. Windows 7 is a great example because people got very, very, very reliant on Windows 7 and the servers around it. And Windows 2008 was another big one that people still use to this day, but its legacy is no longer supported, I don't think, unless you have some kind of special extended Microsoft contract or something. And then they went from Windows 2008 to Service Pack 2 to Service Pack whatever. And now it's like it's not really supported anymore unless you have some kind of special contract. It's a big deal because if your business relied on this thing to make money, you have some code that your team wrote on Windows 2008. And now you have to upgrade because Microsoft no longer supports that operating system. And they've moved on like two other versions. They're on Windows 11 now. And now what are you going to do? It's very difficult. I can tell you that every organization is different. Every organization and every situation is actually different. It just depends. And it's not your call as a cybersecurity person. It's not your call. It's not your call as an IT person. It's management that has to make that decision. They will rely on you for consultation and your advice on what you should do. But they're the ones who have to spend the money. They're the ones who have to make sure the resources go to make that shift, that course correction. So just to give you an example of a couple of organizations I've been to that had to decommission an old system. So one, I'm not going to name names, but not that I could remember them anyway, but one organization that was at, they had a very, very old system that was on, it was on, let's say Windows 2, let's say it was on Windows 98, right? It was old, very, very old, and Microsoft no longer supported it. Nobody could support it anymore, and it had all these vulnerabilities. But this organization relied so heavily on it, they couldn't just get rid of it immediately. So they had to keep it around, and they kept putting compensating controls around it. Contingency, all these contingencies and compensating controls to lower the level of risk that they had around the system. And they had an expiration date of when they're going to decommission it, but they couldn't get rid of it immediately. So they kept on putting disconnect it directly from the main network, the production network, and then they put it in its own, network that was secure, and only four people could access the system, and you had to be there locally to sign in on it, and it was locked in a room. Like they put all of these different compensating controls to make it as secure as possible. So that's one thing I've seen organizations do until they could decommission it. And then on decommission, what they did, it took years because they had to redevelop a whole nother set of code on this other system. They were gonna put it on Red Hat. So they had to rewrite the code from scratch and put it on Red Hat to get away from Windows. And that took years. They thought it was only going to take like maybe 1 year, and it took like 3 years to develop this other code and test it. And in the meantime, they had to have all these compensating controls in place to compensate for all the issues that Windows 98 had. Because Windows 98, you can bypass networking features, you can bypass identification and authentication. You don't have to sign in. There's things you can do to get right in there. You can't even put secure software on it. You can't even put a secure application, because Internet Explorer, in the old one that that support that's supported on that old, you can't secure it anymore at all. So they had to do all kinds of compensating control. That's what they call. That's one of the things that you can do if you have a system that's going to be decommissioned. You could put all these other controls in place to make it so that it's more secure. Limit how many people are can get access to it. Limit its connection to the production network on the internet, and kill the connection to the internet if you can. Put systems in front of it that are the face of the system. And ultimately, the goal is to get rid of that system. So that's what I've seen organizations do. Other ones I've seen replace it immediately. They said, okay, you know what? This is causing too many problems. One organization, not naming any names, they had a very old operating system in their, in a, man, I don't know how much I could, it was in their, in a very unsecure place that people can see publicly. I'll just put it that way. And it's out there, and they were using it, and then they got hacked somewhere else, like another part of the network got hacked, and it just lit a fire under them. And they were like, yo, this is not happening no more. Get that system off the network. And they got it off the network immediately because they got hacked somewhere else. And they were like, it was such a disaster that they saw this, all the legacy systems they had, all the systems that need to be decommissioned. They're like, take it off now. Take it off right now. So I've seen them do that. What other things have I seen them do with decommissioning? Normally, it's they have some kind of plan of action, and it's going to take a while. That's normally what happens, is they have a plan in place, and they put compensating controls, because you can't update it, so you put it behind a firewall, you take it off the network, you disconnect it from the internet, you make it so only five people can log into it, and those people are can only locally sign into it, those kinds of things. Limit it as much as possible, limit the level of exposure, and then slowly decommission it. Have a plan in place to finally get rid of it. And that plan needs to be documented, because leadership is going to have to speak on that plan going forward. Because that's the big, one of the biggest issues is not just security, but also leadership having to justify why it's still there and having a plan to say, okay, yeah, we're going to get rid of it. It's going to take us 2 years, you know. We're a little bit behind, but here's where we are in the project and that kind of thing. So that's one thing, a couple things. Let me see here. Tips on how to break into management. 5 years experience in DRC, currently global IT auditor. So some friends of mine broke into management, and I'm just thinking of like what they did to get into management. And from GRC, one of the good things about GRC is it lends itself to a management type, and you could get into a management type position. One of the ways is just sticking around, hanging around one company. I've noticed the longer I stay at one place, the more times it's offered. Management or supervisory type positions are offered, and that's a doorway. Supervisor type roles are a doorway into that management role. One of the things that works every time for management that I've seen, every person I've seen go from GRC to management, is just be a go-getter. Work extra hours, figure things out, help other people, just be a go-getter. And those are the kinds of people they come to ask you to be in a supervisor position. And that super, and this thing is about a supervisor position is that is a direct entryway into management. And then once you get to management, upper level management. So that's how, see, the best way is to be a go-getter, be a company guy or girl and go after it. Like be the person who's always helping other people, be the person who stays late, comes in early, be the person who always does their time card on time. That works, man. I'm telling you, that works. It really works. It really works. Where should I be focusing on? Where should I be focusing on moving to? Best career move, again, 5 years in GRC. It depends on what you want to do. It really depends on what you want to do. It's not a one-size-fits-all type solution. You said management. You want to do management. So best career move. There's a few things you can do. Management at some companies is pretty competitive. So what you could do is go for start a master's degree, right? That's one thing you can do to kind of tick that box. If you're trying to do management, it will come up. A master's degree will come up, depending on the type of organization. Stay in one organization. Find a good organization and just stay there. Longevity really matters for what you're trying to do. If you're trying to do management and move up in ranks. Another thing is you don't want to stay there. When the next time you make another move, try to move up when you go to another company. That's another thing you can do. If for management, those are probably the things I've seen people win the most with. Another thing would be to get a professional level cert. That would be like a CISSP, a CASP, something like that. A high level CISA, a CISM. Those are high level professional level certs. That just having that will get you senior level positions. You'll get offered opportunities for senior level positions, management positions, and things like that. Okay, Yakuza says you can coin. He's talking about the decommissioning of systems, of decommissioning systems and maintaining security. He says you can quarantine it, put a firewall around it, mitigate it to the cloud, hide it. But the best thing to do is just get rid of it. Amen. That's exactly right. The best thing to do is get rid of it. One of the biggest risks. I know you've seen it as a pen tester. One of the biggest risks to an organization and the biggest hacks that happen, especially from external sources, is when people have end of life and end of support systems, because people, the longer it's out there, especially if it's in a DMZ or externally facing system, people just find all kinds of holes. They find ports, protocols, and services that are just open. And that's the reason why that Microsoft or Red Hat or Mac or whoever, whatever system you have, that's why they're moving away from that operating system, because it just starts taking on too much water, and it's better to just nuke it and go to another system. All right, I think that's it, guys. Thank you so much for watching. It's been about a little bit over an hour, and I apologize for starting late. I had some business stuff to attend to, but I will be back on here again talking about GRC type stuff, answering questions. I appreciate everybody who's jumped on here. I'll try to be better with my mic next time. I hope you guys can hear me on this mic. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Larry, thank you for that, man. I appreciate you. Larry said, this is my last question. Thanks for that $20. He says, Larry, damn, 20 bones. Thanks, Larry. Shout out, Larry. Larry said, the NIST standard is interesting stuff. Some similarities that you would imagine between public-private sector when it comes to information security. I think that the trend will continue. I appreciate the conversation as usual. Oh, thanks a lot, Larry. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for that $20, man. Thanks. That's investing in my drink, my drinks that I have. You know, I have all kinds of drinks back here, and I owe these to my man Larry and a few other people who've been supporting me. And Larry, if you have any kind of websites or products or services, I'll be happy to promote it. I'll make a commercial. I'll put it here on the screen. let me see. Thanks again. Picked up your book on Amazon. Great read. Thank you, sir. Thanks, Jaden. I appreciate you. If you guys didn't know, I've got books. I've got products. I've got services. I've got All kinds of stuff. If you want to learn more about this, you can go to Amazon, search me out, Bruce Brown Combo Courses, NIST 800. You'll find me all over the internet. Got books, got courses, got advice. If you buy my course, one of the things that you have is that you can contact me directly, and I'll help you out as much as possible on private line. We can talk back and forth, and any question you have, that's one of the things we give to my students. We can work it out together, figure it out. Thanks a lot, guys. That's it. The audio is good on TikTok. Thank you so much. But it's bad on YouTube. Oh, damn. All right, I'll fix that. Actually, right after this call, I'm going to fix that right now. All right, guys. See you later. Talk to you next week.